And I'm sure whenever most of you found out that I was going to be preaching tonight, you got just as upset as I did when I found out that I was going to be. I'm on vacation, and so, and Andy would not let it go in the text messages. I tried to avoid it the first time, and then he asked again and had a bunch of like smiley faces like, please do it, please do it. Now, it's a blessing to be able to be with all of you and to be able to present a lesson tonight. And as I look out at the audience, and especially this morning, I don't get to have many services where I get to hold my children. And I was crying a lot during the service this morning, just thinking about when I first started coming here, and I'd come here after I had been working at the gun club all day on Sunday, like sweaty and gross and probably smelly, and how you guys would still give me hugs. And I remember so many of the conversations that I had with so many of you that filled me with really important and helpful insight that I find myself telling to people in California where I'm working. I've been shaped and formed by so many of you guys, and I'm so thankful to God that I've been blessed to have been converted in this area and to have been able to be influenced initially by so many of you guys. I love you guys very much, and there's really no words that I can say that can express the gratitude that I have for everything you guys have ever done for me. All right, we're going to be in Mark 15. And when my first couple of years at Santee, I preached through the Gospel of Mark on Sunday nights. And when I got towards the end of the book and we started looking at the death, burial, and resurrection and the trials of Jesus, I had never really done much study on those sections, and I found myself really gravitating towards a lot of the lessons in it that I had never seen before. And so I want to share with you one of those lessons from towards the end of Mark in chapter 15. But just to maybe help us think about this text before we read it, I try to think for a moment about suffering and the concept of suffering. For the non-Christian in the world, suffering has become one of the biggest reasons why people will say that there is no God, or there's not a very good reason to serve him even if he did exist. But you think about even a Christian. I know a lot of you over the last 8 years or 9 years or 10 years since I've been a Christian have gone through a lot of difficult things. And whenever you've been through those difficult things, you know that there's not like these magic words somebody's going to tell you that's just going to make the emotion of the trial go away. But one of the things that you can say that Christianity offers that no other religion offers is what John chapter 1 verse 11 says when it says that he came to his own and his own did not receive him. That Jesus left the glories of heaven like we just sang about and entered into human suffering. When John 1:11 says that his own didn't receive him, I find it interesting that the name of the disciple that betrayed him was Judas. And in the Greek, it's the same thing as Judah. Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. Like, his own did not receive him. And Christianity is the only religion that can say that God entered into humanity and suffered unjustly. And so he understands all the things that we go through. And one of the things that we're told as Christians to do is to think about and meditate on the fact that he understands those things. That's Hebrews 2 and 4. This passage in Mark chapter 15 is, I think it naturally breaks up into two sections. It's the him on the cross and then his death. We're just going to look at him on the cross. We're not going to look at his death. But let's go ahead and read Mark chapter 15, starting in verse 16. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they were striking his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak, and put his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Now, what we're looking at in this section is extremely critical to our faith in understanding what it is that Jesus has done for us. And there's other passages in the Bible that allude a lot to this passage. There's a lot of ones from the Old Testament, a lot of ones from the New Testament. One of those, for example, is Philippians 2:8, that says that Jesus humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. You notice that as Paul is reflecting on this scene that we just read, notice how he says that he humbled himself even to death on the cross. What I learned from that is that the only kind of people that follow Jesus' example in this text are humble people. And a lot of people today will maybe not fully understand the historical background to what the crucifixion was all about, so we make it into necklaces and things like that. Not that that's always wrong to do that. But here it shows that it's only a humble person that really understands and follows what's happening here. Another passage that is referenced with this scene is 1 Corinthians 1:23. "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to Gentiles." You know, you think about what's happening in this scene here, and Jesus is being proclaimed as the king in a mocking kind of way, and we'll talk more about that in just a second. But here's Jesus on the cross, and this is his moment of glory. And you try to preach that to a Gentile, and you say, the king was crucified, and they say, "No, we wouldn't get that wrong. We're professionals at executing people. We wouldn't have gotten the wrong guy." And then you try to talk to Jews about it, and they just stumble over it. This scene does not make sense to a lot of different worldviews in the time of Jesus. But try to think about some of the ironic things that are happening in this text. In this text, you've got all kinds of ironic things that are happening. Here's the first one. Jesus is in a mocking way being proclaimed as king. Every king needs to have people who believe that he's the king. Otherwise, you're just a crazy guy that thinks you're a king. Here, in a mocking kind of way, you've got all these people watching him pinned up to the cross, saying things like, "Hail, King of the Jews." But you also notice that every king needs to be enthroned on a throne. And there's a sense in which when Jesus is on the cross, the throne became his cross. And so John's gospel would talk a lot about that. But every king also needs kingly attire. They need to wear the purple robes. They need to have the scepter. And you've got the Roman guards in very mocking kinds of ways, giving him things that would be appropriate, but they're doing it in a mocking kind of way and not in the right way either. So there's kingly irony going on. But look at some of the mocking that's being said about Jesus while he's on the cross. For example, in verse 29, in quoting John 2, they're saying, "You said that you could rebuild the temple in 3 days. How about you come down and start rebuilding that temple?" And of course, Jesus was referring to the temple of his body. And the only way that that temple would ever be able to be rebuilt in 3 days is if he stayed on the cross. But you look at verse 31, some of the other people that are mocking him are saying that he saved others and he cannot save himself. The truth was that the only way he could ever save anybody else is if he didn't save himself. So there's all of these ironic things happening to him and being said about him while he's on the cross. But some people might look at a scene like this in the gospel and say, "Well, you know, I don't really believe that these kinds of things happened." And of course, for the Christian, this is a very, very critical moment in the gospels. And one of the things that's interesting about this scene that is not recorded in the other gospels is connected to Simon of Cyrene. Matthew's gospel and Luke's gospel name Simon of Cyrene, but Mark's gospel is the only one that in verse 21 mention Alexander and Rufus. It makes you wonder, why would you name the children of Simon of Cyrene? Well, can you think of any other time in the Bible that either of these guys are named? At the end of the end of Romans chapter 16, verse 13, greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord. Why is it the case that Mark's gospel would name these two people that none of the other gospels do? I think here's the answer to it. Because the people living in Rome that we know about in the book of Romans would have had access to Rufus. By the way, the gospel of Mark was written to a Roman audience. So if they would have received this letter of Mark and they started reading it and they heard about Simon of Cyrene and his two children, Alexander and Rufus, they could go verify all the things that happened here by going and talking to Rufus about this event. And he could say, yeah, my dad was there. And my dad actually did carry the cross. And so I can tell you with certainty that these things all happened because I'm connected to an eyewitness. Now I want you to try to imagine what's happening in this scene. Now in this scene, you have like a convergence of a ton of Old Testament prophecies being fulfilled here. But in this moment when Jesus is being mocked, he would have been scourged at this point, which would have meant that his hands would have been tied to a post and he would have been whipped with a cat of nine tails. And after all of that happens, he's led inside the governor's headquarters with a bunch of the Roman soldiers. Now, the Roman soldiers, their job was to make sure that there was no riots that would happen. And so what they end up doing as they're with Jesus is they treat him like he's a play toy. And so they twist together this crown of thorns and they place it on his head. By the way, have you ever thought about the significance of the crown of thorns on the head? Where do we first read about thorns in the Bible? In Genesis chapter 3 with the curses. And now here's the curses being placed on the head of the Son of God. So they place the crown of thorns on his head and they're saluting him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They're saying all of these kinds of mocking things towards him. But throughout this whole scene, a lot of the way that Jesus is treated gets ramped up. So these same soldiers, they take a reed and a fake scepter and they give it to him, but then they start striking him on the head. Can you imagine all of the thorns digging into his head? And it doesn't take a big scratch on the head for a lot of blood to come out. So you can imagine all the blood pouring out of his head. But the text says that it was the whole battalion that was with him in this moment. I've done some research on this, and I guess a whole battalion could be up to 200 soldiers. Can you imagine 200 people spitting on Jesus? Like, I used to imagine in my mind that it was like 15 people and they're spitting on him. But here, it could be up to 200 people and the spit would have been drenching him. Fulfilling what Isaiah chapter 50, verse 6, "I gave my back to those who strike and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting." 700 years before this event, Isaiah wrote about this. And so we see that happening in this text. But notice after they treat him in this way, after they finish mocking him, they strip the purple cloak off of him, and you can imagine the blood would have connected to him. And as they strip the purple cloak off, it would have reopened all of the wounds. But now it's time for him to go out to Golgotha, the place of the skull, which would have been outside the city walls. So you can imagine that as he started to go out, what they would have carried back then was the horizontal part of the crucifix, which is called the patibulum. And it would have weighed up to 150 pounds. So here's Jesus, and he's starting out walking, and we know from John 19, verse 17, he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is Golgotha. So he starts out all by himself, but after I don't know how long he's been walking, you can imagine how exhausted he's been. He's been up all night, he's already been scourged. So they get this passerby, Simon of Cyrene, to help him. And as he gets to this place, they offer him wine mixed with myrrh, which would have been like an ancient form of a painkiller. And Jesus isn't going to take it. Because Jesus is going to experience the full force of everything that's about to happen. Now, have you ever noticed that when you read the Gospels, that none of the Gospels really detail the actual moment of his crucifixion? Like, if you look at verse 24, there's four simple words. "And they crucified him." What does that mean? It means that they would have stripped him most likely completely naked. and they would have nailed his hands to the crossbeam and then lifted up the crossbeam onto the vertical one. And they put him in this position up on the cross where it would be very hard to get any kind of good breath. And there he is, the Son of God in the middle cross. And as he's up there, do you see what the soldiers are doing? Try to imagine this scene. You've got, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and you've got these soldiers, and they're dividing up the garments, trying to get whatever they can from him. It's fulfilling Psalm 22:18. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And right above him, it says, King of the Jews. Just a horrific kind of scene that we see. But what makes this even more eerie in some ways is that between Jesus, you've got two robbers on his right and on his left. He's the one that's in the middle, so he's flanked by two robbers. And one of the things that this passage does for me is it helps me understand passages like this in Isaiah 53, verse 12, that Jesus was numbered with the transgressors. People were looking up at those three crosses, and they would have thought, criminal, criminal, criminal. He's numbered right along with all the other people, and with Jesus up on this cross, there's three waves of mocking that happens. The first wave of mockers are just passerbys. I guess this was along a road or something like that, and people could walk around and they could deride him, saying, you who rebuild the temple in 3 days, come down and save yourself. But notice the second wave of mocking. In verses 31 and 32, the second group that's mocking Jesus are the chief priests and the scribes. Notice that verse 31 says that they mocked him to one another. You know what I imagine in my mind then? Is that you've got these chief priests and these scribes who I don't think normally attended crucifixions. But I think they're reveling in the success that they think that they've developed for themselves. And so they're talking to each other with Jesus right there, saying all kinds of terrible things about him. Here's a question about these mockers so far. What kind of person does it take to look at somebody bleeding out on a cross and to mock the person? What kind of person does that? But the third group of people that are mocking Jesus comes from a very unlikely source. It's actually coming from the two robbers. Try to imagine the two robbers looking in at the middle person and saying all kinds of terrible things about the guy, even though they're about to die themselves. We know from Luke's account in Luke 23, verses 42 and 43, and he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, I'm going to come back to that at the end of the sermon. But Jesus is willing to pardon somebody even while he's on the cross in this moment. Now, what do we do with a scene like this? What lessons do we learn from this moment of the Son of God being crucified on a cross like this? Maybe the first thing that I want to point out in this scene is why Jesus is suffering to begin with. Why is any of this happening to him? Did you notice how the text begins and how it ends? Starting at verse 16, or in verse 18, the way that the Romans are making fun of Jesus is they're saying, Hail, King of the Jews! Look at verse 32, the people were calling him the King of Israel. We can tell why Jesus was suffering based on what they were mocking him about, because it implies what they were upset about with him. Throughout history, kings have always had the right to judge and make examples of people in a society. Throughout ancient societies, kings have always had like complete control. And try to imagine that you've got this guy that didn't come from any significant family. And he's walking around saying, unless you believe in me, you will die in your sins. Have you ever actually had like a regular human being say something like that to you? When I was in Tennessee, there was one night when I was on a run around our neighborhood, and there's this guy that started visiting the church, and he had some kinds of issues. But I was walking around, or I was on this run, and I was at the street corner, and there he was. There was Charles. And he was yelling at people that they were all going to go to hell. And I came up to him, and I said, man, what are you doing right now? And he said, he just looked at me, and he said, I have the power to cast you into hell this very moment. And when I heard that, I thought, well, you're pretty crazy. And he was. But try to imagine that you lived in the ancient days when Jesus was walking around. A lot of the times we think that if we would have seen Jesus do the miracles, it would be a lot easier to believe in him. Here's a man walking around making claims like that. You think it's going to be easy to believe in somebody like that? Now, this maybe sheds light on why people today will kind of treat Jesus the same way. Don't people still mock Jesus and try to strip him out of their life in various different kinds of ways? Why do people do that? It's because Jesus in the scriptures make absolute claims on your life that you have to submit to him. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3 says, "Scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing." Notice the last part of that verse, though. "Following their own sinful desires." What's the motivation? Their own sinful desires. I don't know if you guys have ever listened to or done any reading from Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or some of these modern-day atheists. Really, what it sounds like they're saying is, "I don't believe in God and I hate him." It's just lots of angry kinds of things that people say. And they come up with all these arguments that sound really sophisticated. But you know what is really behind all of these things? Is you want to do what you want to do. Oftentimes. When I started to understand more and more that this is what the Bible says is the most common reason, I think, for why people disbelieve, it causes me to change the way that I approach conversations with people when I'm trying to teach them the Bible. Have you guys ever met somebody who was wondering why they could ever believe in the Bible? Or how a good and loving God could ever exist because of all the suffering in the world? They come up with all of these kinds of questions that sometimes are coming from a legitimate place. But what I oftentimes do now whenever I start getting questions like that from somebody is I say to them, "Look, we'll talk about those things if you want to talk about them. But I have a question for you first. Is there something that God has asked you to give up that you don't want to give up? Is there something that God has asked you to start pursuing that you don't want to pursue?" And oftentimes when I've asked that question, we get to the heart of what's really going on, and all of these other discussions about why I don't believe in the Bible are really just superficial, and the deeper reason is I don't want to have to submit. This maybe explains why we sometimes go through our suffering. If Jesus is pinned up to the cross because of his claims to be the king, why is it that the world doesn't like Christians? It's because whenever we're trying to talk to other people about God in the Bible, they know that it makes inherent claims on the way that they have to live. Have you ever had a time like this where you're at a restaurant and the first person orders their meal and they say, "I want a big, fat, juicy hamburger." And then the next person's like, "Yeah, I want that too." And then the third person's like, "I want a salad." And it makes, all the first two people feel terrible because their ways of eating has been exposed by the salad eater. This is true on a much wider kind of scale where you're in your workplace and you're trying to do the right thing and you're trying to shine the light. And the reason why everybody around you doesn't like you sometimes has nothing to do with your personality, I hope. It has more to do with the fact that you're trying to be a conduit of the light of God that makes them uncomfortable about their own life. And because of that, Jesus suffered, and his servants are going to suffer as well. So that's the first thing that we see is why Jesus suffered. But notice the second thing, Jesus' example in the midst of his suffering. One of the ways that I try to make applications in Scripture is by seeing what other passages in the Bible say about the specific passage I'm looking at. Go over to 1 Peter chapter 2. This passage alludes to this very text that we've been looking at in Mark 15. 1 Peter chapter 2. And we'll look at verses, we'll do 21 to 24. "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but you have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." When Peter writes this letter, if you read the totality of 1 Peter, you'll notice that what the audience is going through is mainly verbal persecution. And you notice in this text even, it talks about how Jesus didn't revile, there was no deceit found in his mouth. When the Gospels record Jesus' suffering while he's on the cross, it doesn't emphasize his physical pain, it emphasizes what people are saying about him and to him, just like 1 Peter does with the audience. So there's a kind of connection there in that way. But notice that Peter brings up how Jesus responded while he was on the cross. You've got all these people mistreating him and spitting on him and doing all these kinds of things, and he did not fight fire with fire. He didn't threaten anybody. He didn't verbally attack anybody. Now, try to think about why Peter is saying this in this context. Like, go back up to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. When Peter writes this letter, you've got the audience going through all kinds of turmoil because of the governors and the emperors at the time. How many of you like to complain about the state of our country and like the president and like the politicians in our day right now? How many of you feel like you're suffering because of those people? How many of you like to verbally say things about that? This is what Peter is saying. When you're going through trials and afflictions, you need to watch your mouth. He says that in the context because of government officials that they might not have liked. Look at why else he says this, though, in verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and the gentle, but also to the unjust. Here's the work relationship. How many of you would say that you have a toxic environment in your workplace? Where your boss is not treating you the way that you'd like. Fortunately, in this country, we can switch jobs if we want because we're not slaves like they were back then. But how many of you like to complain about those kinds of things? Notice again that 1 Peter is talking about how we use our mouth in the midst of suffering. Do you complain about those things? Do you fight fire with fire? Look over at chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. Have you ever suffered from somebody in your family? And because your family members don't like the way that you're serving God, it causes you to say things that you ought not say. Now, maybe we could illustrate it this way. If you squish a bug, what comes out of a bug? Bug guts. If you take an orange and squish an orange, I'm not strong enough to do that, but if you did it, if you were strong enough to do it, what comes out of the orange? Orange juice. When you get pressured in, and you feel pressured by all of the things around you that aren't the way that you like them to be, oftentimes what I like to say is, well, you caused me to say that, or you caused me to do that, when really all that was happening is the thing that was always in me was getting revealed. Just like the bug guts and the orange juice. A lot of you realize that when I first became a Christian, the way that I conducted myself at certain times was not very godly. And there was a lot of you that would talk to me about how I needed to treat my family in a better kind of way. One of the things that trials do for us is they reveal what's really going inside of our heart. But when you look at the example of Jesus, Jesus did not justify spitting back at the people. Now, how did he do that, though? Like, how did he keep his composure? If you look at verse 23 in 1 Peter 2, you get kind of into the psychology of Jesus, because it says that he continued entrusting himself to the one who judges justly. How did Jesus work through it? He must have continually thought to himself, God is the righteous judge, God is the righteous judge, God is the righteous judge. Now, one day he was going to have judgment in his own hands. But in the moment, it was not his place to do that. Do you know why we sometimes fight fire with fire? It's because we're forgetting the fact that God is the one who has perfect knowledge to judge perfectly. And we're forgetting the fact that God is the one who's powerful enough to judge in the proper way. And any attempts that we try to do with that is not going to do what it needs to. The good news of Judgment Day is that God's going to settle those accounts one day, and that's not really our business. So we see Jesus' example in suffering, and that's how he handled himself while he was on the cross. But the final thing that I want us to see is what Jesus gained through his suffering. This is another passage that helps us get into the mind of Jesus while he was on the cross. Look at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. We've talked so far in this lesson about the external kinds of pressures that we experience in trying to serve God. This text gets us to the inside a little bit in verse 1, when it says to lay aside every weight and sin that clings so closely. One of the ways that Christians suffer is not just going to be based on what people say about us and to us. There's a sense in which every Christian, I think, ought to be suffering every day. Hebrews 2:18 says that Jesus suffered when tempted. Why did he suffer when he was tempted? Because sin promises momentary pleasure, doesn't it? And so every time I say no to sin, I'm suffering because I did not indulge in that momentary pleasure. And so this text is talking about laying aside all of the weight and sin and enduring the external pressures as well as we seek to serve God. But how is it that Jesus did it? How did he do it? It says in this text, because of the joy set before him. In other words, he was looking to the future. But what, I have a question about this. What was the joy that was set before Jesus? What was it? Maybe it was the joy of Jesus going back to the Father. But he had experienced that before. So I don't think that's fully the answer to it. Here's maybe a better way to ask this. What was it that Jesus' suffering gave him that he did not have before? It was you. It was me. It was the bride of Christ. The joy set before Jesus, yes, was being back with the Father, but it was also going to be the bride that he was going to purchase back by his suffering on the cross. And this gives us the secret to be able to understand how we go through our suffering. The joy that Jesus had set before him was us. The joy set before us is Jesus. And one day we get to be with him forever. And because of that, the more we continually think about the joy that's set before us, the more we're going to be able to handle the things that we go through in this life in a way that doesn't cause us to give up. I think Jesus, by the way, started to experience some of that while he was on the cross, with the thief that was on the cross. Follow what I'm about to say, but I think that day there was three crosses. There were three robbers. You had two unrighteous robbers, and then you had a righteous robber in the middle. You remember back in Mark chapter 3 where Jesus talked about entering the strong man's house and plundering his goods? You've got two unrighteous robbers. One of them repents because Jesus is stealing him back from Satan even while he's pinned to the cross. The question for us tonight is this. Has Jesus stolen your heart? Does he have it? Has he taken it back from Satan because of this moment that he did for us on the cross and his resurrection? When I was in Tennessee, there was a kid that I used to study with every week, and it was one of those situations where it was a difficult family life, and his dad was never there, and the grandma was kind of the one that was trying to raise him, and he was getting to a point where he didn't believe in the Bible anymore, and he was struggling with all of those kinds of things, and he just could never muster up the strength or the desire, or whatever you want to say it, to read the Bible and serve God. And so after talking about so many different things with him from so many different kinds of angles, I eventually just decided to read the crucifixion scene with him. And he started to cry. And I started to explain to him that when you think of love, you don't think of like this red heart. This is what you think about. Jesus Christ dying on the cross for you. Here's the Son of God entering into human suffering for you. if that doesn't capture your heart, I don't know what else is going to do that for you. Where are you at tonight? Are you in a position tonight where you have not yet started serving God? We're about to sing the song, Jesus Paid It All. And because of that, we owe Him everything. If you've not yet begun serving Him and have your heart melted by His love for you, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.